The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Line engineers. A line engineer is what you and I would call a practicing engineer. That term is used in distinction to management. Who are people who were at one time line engineers, for the most part. When I say engineer management, I'm saying engineering management. Okay. And as you recall from the Challenger case, when this vice president took off his engineering hat and put on his management hat and changed the decision, there are different points of view and different professional responsibilities that engineers, line engineers, have as opposed to engineering managers. And engineering managers have the greater authority. There is definitely a difference in job requirement and for this class, contract and point of view. So, the professional societies are largely line engineers. However, the leaderships of these professional societies are largely managers. Okay. So the NSPE came along. They were young engineers. They were almost all line engineers. They were idealistic. And they wanted engineering to do all of the right things, even if it meant some bad things for their client or employer. All right? And they set the mold with this code of ethics. And in the 60s, the late 60s, when we had all of the social movements that led to the creation of the STS and then engineering ethics, that movement was sympathetic to the NSPE code, not to the ASE and the others. So eventually they all came as close to NSPE as they could get. So so you find this difference between management and line engineer in the university. If you observe the faculty and administration, then the likenesses and the differences are going to be very much the same between line engineers and managers. There's this book. There were some books that were very scathing on the academy that came out in the 60s. One was called The Professor Scam, and there were a bunch of others. And one of them had on the cover that what are we talking about here when we say administration versus faculty. This is written for the general public. They're all the same. That's what this person was trying to create in the eyes of the general public, and he had good reasons. He said they're all the same. He said, so far as we're concerned, they all got PhDs. They were all faculty members at least at one time. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you talking about? A college president can't get a presidency without having a full professorship in one of the academic departments at most places, at all places that I know of. All right. So from the outside, we're splitting hairs. Okay. Someone could say the same thing about engineering, the profession, that we're splitting hairs when you talk about engineering management versus engineers. And there is a gray area in the university where it's hard for everybody to decide whether the department chairs are managers or faculty. Varies from institution to institution, from time to time, but even and from department to department. But even there's this real gray area that's hard to deal with. And at many institutions, a department chair has to be reviewed by her faculty every so often. If the review is bad, you're out. The department chair has to be reviewed by the dean every day. So the department chair is in the between, sort of a in-between case. And I'm certain that, and in all the places that I have worked, not many, but we're talking about NASA, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, there is a position of responsibility that I liken to department chairs. It's kind of hard to decide where they fit. Okay. So the other important thing is to remember that I did say, and that is that the sentiments of the late 60s that brought STS and thus engineering ethics into being were on the side of NSPE and the line engineers, because that's where you get mainly the whistleblowers from and all of that. Okay, things can change. Things had changed, but that's where we are. And the importance of NSPE is that most of the codes, I think it's fair to say, the lion's share of the codes that are out, that are in force today, use the NSP code as a starting point. That's right. And I don't know what word is best to describe the relationship between the two. It varies from time to time, place to place. But you need to be aware that there's a line. And if you want to be vice president for engineering, you're going to have to go up through the management line, and you're going to have to deal with these people. People who that you were a part of. Right. And they're going to have to deal with you. Also, there's another subtlety, and that is that once you decide to go the management route, it's very difficult to come back because you lose those skills. A person who is not a professional is going to find what I'm about to say impossible to believe. You do not have to know more or even as much as the people know that you manage in order to manage them well. And a good place to learn it is in the Army. Second lieutenant, 22 years old. Sergeant, 40 years old. Second to lieutenant doesn't know one-tenth of what the sergeant knows. But the lieutenant is not supposed to know. The lieutenant is supposed to know when the job is done right and when it's wrong and when to pass the order down from the higher. Interface that unit with the higher unit. But the sergeant's supposed to know all this other stuff. And the lieutenant tells the sergeant what to do, and the sergeant gets the men organized. Tell them what to do and do all of that. So you have to learn and appreciate that. That's, engineering is set up the same way. That you don't know as much about putting steel in concrete as the steel workers do. Even if you did know, right? Even if you did know, even if you were a steel worker and now a manager, a couple years down the line, you're going to lose your competency. Things are going to change. That's right. So that's another thing you have to deal with. So let's see if we can't interrogate this code. How is it organized? Does it have a preamble? Does it have sections? All right.
It has like four distinct sections.
What are they?
Preamble, which describes what engineering is as a profession. which I pretty much repeated in all of the other codes, except maybe IEEE.
Yes.
So there's fundamental canons, preamble fundamental canons, which are brief, then the rules of practice, which are divided up according to each fundamental canon, and then professional obligations.
Okay.
Well,
is the preamble, let's read the preamble, and then let's go through the canons. There are how many? Six or seven of them?
Six.
Let's go through the canons, and then let's pick out any of the other parts that we want to talk about. So somebody read the preamble, please.
Engineering is an important and learned profession. As members of this profession, engineers are expected to exhibit the highest standards of honesty and integrity. Engineering has a direct and vital impact on the quality of life for all people. Accordingly, the services provided by engineers require honesty, impartiality, fairness, and equity, and must be dedicated to the protection of the public health, safety, and welfare. Engineers must perform under a standard of professional behavior that requires adherence to the highest principles of ethical conduct.
Okay, so there's a statement of what the profession is. Subject to debate, but that's the statement that is authorized by this organization. All right. Do we have any problems with that statement? Yeah, we got problems with the statement. Do we think that when I say we have problems, you come in any way you want, but I really want to know if you think that there's anything about that statement that should not be in a professional organization's preamble up to its code of ethics. Have they deceived anybody about the greatness of engineering?
Well, what strikes me when I read this is, wow, this is not something that all engineers either believe or are given the opportunity to believe, because it's not a definition of engineering that is ever presented to them.
Right.
That doesn't answer your question of whether or not anything that they put in here should be wrong, but...
Well, it does. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Is it rubbing up against this pen, I think? Oh. Okay. Thank you.
This actually makes me think of something
else
that
said. Yes. Yeah, if there's anything wrong with it, it might be too idealistic, and that it's all right to shoot after as a goal. Yeah, that's good. I think that's a good way to think about it. As to whether or not all the engineers buy into it, well, the question is, what is their decision-making method? I don't think that they use a plebiscite where you go out and take the majority of everybody. No, they get a committee.
Right. I mean, it's just that when you're a college engineering student, no one ever said, at most, at the two universities that I'm at,
yeah.
No one says, great that you're doing engineering.
Right.
Engineering has a very high level of time and quality. And you're expected to have that here, so you're a college student. So now I wish they would say that.
Yes.
I wish that we would talk about
yes.
That.
Well, there's another way to think about it. They've got it published, and if you don't like it, you don't have to join NSPE. Now, that's another way to think about it. Doesn't mean that you agree with it, but if you still want to join NSPE, you have to take responsibility for that statement some way or another. You did it with your eyes open. It's published.
It's a really demanding statement.
Yeah.
I think, to say that our services are honesty, impartiality, fairness, ethics, dedicated. Those are, none of us ever live up to all those things.
Well, the price you pay for that, or not the price, but a price that you pay for that is if you go to court, the judge is going to take that position, mm-hmm. literally. The judge is going to say, here it is, it's published. I got a copy of it. Everybody's got a copy of it. Over here, I see where your application. You asked to be a member. Nobody came down and said, you've got to be one or else we'll fire you. Nobody said that. You paid your dues every year for the last 10 years. You had time to change your mind after you got experience. But no, you kept your mouth shut. You're going to have to pay the price. You're going to have to live up to that. All right, so that's another way to think about this whole thing. So, yeah, they decide to subscribe to it. And so, therefore, if they come before, let's say, a community group or a high school, PTA, and they say, well, what do you stand for? What is engineering? Then you look like a liar if you don't say something like this. Okay. So, because you belong. You ask to belong. It's a free country. You don't have to belong. Okay. All right. So there is the goal. Now, the fundamental canons are more or less, the preamble is sort of the end, and the fundamental canons are the means laid out in general terms. And we get specifics later, and the idea with the specifics is that when we review the code and decide to make changes or make additions, if we've done things right, the preamble and the fundamental canons remain the same. We only change the rest of it, the details. In other words, there's something that's about our organization, one would say, who is a member, one would say, that has lasting value. And the preamble and the fundamental canons, if you're doing things right, have lasting value. And that the details about how you carry it out may change from time to time. And another way to think about it is that the fundamental canons lay down your strategy and the rules of practice, and the last part are your tactics. See, it all fits, right? Remember the basketball metaphor? Did we do that in this class? Yeah, we did it. Big guys can go for the, yeah. Right. So the strategy for achieving this goal is laid down in your six fundamental canons, and your tactics are laid down in the rest of it. Now, let's go through these canons. There's only six of them. Let's go through them one by one because, as you said, we're going to find them elsewhere. What's the first one say?
Engineers in fulfillment of their professional duties shall hold paramount the safety, health, and welfare.
Now, whatever you do in this life, put an asterisk beside that statement, because that is the fundamental point of controversy over engineering ethics in the 20th century. It is number one. I do not stand alone when using that superlative. It is the most debated, highest debated issue. And the NSPE was the first one to come out early and say that responsibility for the public is more important than responsibility for the client and the employer. They were the first to jump out and say that. And you can see that if an organization is controlled by managers, they were going to have problems with that statement. And the typical response from a management point of view is that there are competing interests that that an engineer has to satisfy. One is the public, one is the client, and the other one is the employee. And NSPE comes right out and uses this word paramount. Okay. And by the way, Arne Veselin's last book, he's got a new one I just heard. But let's say it this way. His latest book is entitled Hold Paramount. Okay, so that means that now you have what is called a super principle. That principle, number one, is more overriding over the next five. And certainly the one I was in with the AAES, and when I was in the one with the AAES, I was very much aware of what the other ones were doing. Because we would call each other, all of that kind of stuff. I had to go out and give all of these speeches on behalf of my committee. And we all had the same problem. And the AAES, when we get to it, I just have a burning issue to say this right now. We worked on the thing for, must have been about 5 years. And I was on the committee the last maybe 3 years of it, and I was chair of it the last 2 years of it. And we did not get a code of ethics until we passed this paramountcy rule. And then we had one. We were not, the committee was not willing to submit anything. Until we resolved the issue among ourselves. It was fought that hard. And I'll tell you what happened there. This is open, I'll call names. There was a guy who was a manager named Bill Middleton. He was on the committee. And he was a very thoughtful person. And he was very strong on the side of balancing, that's the term, balancing competing interests, and for a long time. And then, I don't know who said it, it wasn't me, but somebody said something in there that worked on his heart. I don't know what it was. But he got on the train going back home to Philadelphia, and he wrote up what he thought should be our fundamental canons, and he put a paramountcy rule in there. I don't think he used the word paramount, but he made it more paramount. And he sent it back to me and said he got it to him on the train. When I got it, I put it in the code. And I called the president of the organization. I said, we finished the code. I said, now I have to tell you, I don't have the vote in writing. He said, well, we've been waiting on this thing for 6 years. He said, will you take responsibility for it? I said, I will. I sent it up, Ned. We had it. Nobody objected once it went in because it came out of this man's heart. He found some correlation between what was in his unconscious and his conscious. And I said, when that thing comes out, everybody's going to buy it. Or a person who doesn't buy it is not going to fight against it.
So is the argument for not having a paramountcy clause that you don't balance competing interests?
Right.
Yes,
and it hurts business. People argue. Okay, and then you get into this whole thing about gray areas and complexity. And most of the issues weren't gray and they weren't complex, but they really wanted a profession. In which every member felt a deep sense of loyalty to whoever was putting the paycheck on the table.
And the people who were advocating for not having a paramount clause wanted that.
Right. Thought that you could not, that the profession would break down because people would not be loyal to the ones they worked for.
saw themselves as serving the public, not necessarily.
Right. There was this question as to whether or not you should serve the public, or whether it was somebody else's problem to serve the public, or whether you just needed to balance, quote unquote, these competing interests. And my position on there when it came to the word balance is you got to have a rule for what establishes a balance. All right. What is that rule? Nobody could give me the rule, because that goes back to a paramountcy. Something got to be paramount.
Right.
So if you use that word rule, what do you mean by balance? What constitutes a balance? Well, that confused the issue for everybody enough for us to start thinking about the paramountcy rule. Yeah.
Because they don't use the word paramount.
Right.
Their first canon says to accept responsibility in making engineering decisions consistent with the safety, health, and welfare of the public, right, and to disclose promptly factors that might endanger the public and the environment.
Right.
So, is that an alternative? Is that an alternative that you all were considering?
Something like that? No. The IEEE, well, let's say a few things about the IEEE. First of all, what they had to say back in those days was very important, because they were the largest engineering professional organization. And secondly, they were the largest partly because in those days, the electrical engineering departments in colleges were the largest. Most of the students were in, most of the jobs were in electrical engineering. Now that's sort of shifted to computer science, I believe. Computer engineering and computer science. But electrical was the biggest one. And lastly, IEEE was an international organization. It wasn't the Americans. So they had to be concerned about international concerns. All of that weighed in with them. So it looked for a while as though IEEE was going to, control is not the right word, dominate is the right word, dominate everybody else. And it didn't work. So IEEE has stood by what they wrote all of these years, and they are just separate from most from the rest.
Yeah, it just seems like there's so much more gray area for what their first canon means. To accept responsibility in making decisions consistent with the public safety is so different than saying, hold paramount.
Right.
What exactly does it mean to accept responsibility? Does that mean you can still make a bad decision and accept responsibility for it?
No. Yeah. Well, there's one thing that is good about it that I take a lesson from, but I don't, and that is that it presupposes that you can do engineering and not have to sacrifice your employer or client to do the right thing, that they're always compatible. Now, the lesson that I take from that is that, well, I don't believe that they're always compatible. But what I do believe is that competency is almost always compatible. I mean, if you're really good at what you do, you should be able to do it and do the right thing. Now, what I'm really after in that argument, to be quite honest and specific about it, is I am less concerned as to whether or not you can do both than I am concerned that to do one or the other is definitely incompetent. I mean, it builds into the culture that you're real smart if you can kill all of the enemy and their babies and their dogs and everything and say that, well, I had to do it. Competent, you say, well, no, I'm just going to kill the soldiers, the ones that are armed. And we're not going to hit the civilians, and I will be as effective as you are with that murder of everybody. Okay, so it builds in a culture that, going back to culture again, it builds in what I call a bad culture. Now, So I think that that we have the lay of the land. IEEE is really trying to say something that I don't think everybody can believe, and that is that you can always do these things the right way. I think that it's the right. In other words, here's what I would say. Now, emphasize, I'm taking a stand. Okay, now you can take your stance, but I can justify my stand. I would take that statement and put it in the preamble as an ideal that we shoot for.
The whole canon or the idea that it is always possible to satisfy?
The whole idea. I would take the canon out, I would put it up there as the first draft, and then I'd work on it till it all came out and made sense. Okay. Can we go back to NSPE? Hi, Tony. We're doing the NSPE code. What's the second canon? Are we done with the first? Yeah.
But how do the people who subscribe to this code of ethics, like, how would they show that they know what welfare means?
That was a hotly debated word.
That's a word we really only use in normal conversation to talk about government programs.
Right.
You know? So.
Well, I was in a meeting when some engineers, three of them from the same state, got up and walked out of the meeting. Said, you can't find a substitute for that word welfare. We're not going to even participate. Don't count us in it. They got up and walked out. Never came back. Because it had too many political connotations. Now, the political connotation was that the government is, I mean, this was the connotation that was applied to the word welfare in these discussions. The connotation was that the government is giving money to somebody not to work, and they can live just as well as I am, and I am working. Now, that was the nightmare in the American psyche that was built into the movements in the middle and late 60s. And the movement said that welfare was for people who either did not get their civil rights and therefore needed subsistence, or that you really don't want to have a country wherein people are suffering and have every reason to rise up against the country. I mean, no matter what your failure in life may be, you don't want your child to starve. And you will become a communist, all of these other things. Okay. So, Branch Davidian, all of these groups that break out are people who are sore about failure. And you don't want a country, particularly one that is, that's what the argument went, particularly one that's profitable, I mean, as rich as ours, to have that problem. Okay, so those were the two sides of it. When they got it into these debates, frankly, I tell you, I just don't know why the people who use the word welfare were not going to yield on that point. I tried some other words. I couldn't find it. I didn't see where welfare was a necessary word.
Right. And it is a loaded word. I didn't
think it was loaded.
I mean, you can say, let's just use the dictionary denotation of welfare.
Yes.
Which is like well-being.
Yeah.
More than that. But the fact of the matter is, most people think of the connotation of the word.
And the people who were dissatisfied with it at the time are still dissatisfied. They don't like that word. The good news is the time has passed and a whole lot. We've got a whole generation out here who really doesn't know what that doesn't feel those. Right. They'll happen to say, well, we're looking at the dictionary. Say, okay. So the good news is it no longer seems to me to make a difference. But it was loaded, and like I said, I like the word welfare, but I could find a substitute. All right, if that makes you mad, I'll find another one that means the same thing. And if that makes you mad, then I see there's no way for us to come to any conclusion. But I was willing to find a substitute. But the people who laid on that word welfare, bang there.
They just thought it was the only word they captured.
That's right. And they were going to do it. And it won, if you want to put it in terms of winning and losing. Welfare was that's a good term. Was a loaded term in those days. Loaded. But it came out. Okay, where else are we now? Somebody read number two.
Kristen, you have the longer version. I have performed services only in areas of your competence. That's what I actually...
Now, that was a contested one.
Yeah, I was really... That one... I thought a lot about that one also.
Yes. Well... Yes. Hotly contested.
That we shouldn't constrain engineers to performing only in their company.
That's right. And I'll tell you why. There was one guy, I can't remember his name or what organization he represented, because in the AAES, everybody was a representative of one of the member organizations. I can't remember what organization, but he put it very articulately, and he fought very hard for it. Lost in the end, but he fought fair. His argument was that there are two kinds of engineering organizations, big ones and little ones. So if you got a small company out here, let's say the three of y'all get together and say you're going to get incorporated, and you wind up hiring 20 people, okay, and you're making good money. Then something on the job, a fuse bust loose, and you have to fix that electrical wiring. You don't have the money to be going out to hire an electrical engineer to come in on the spot because you got your critical path schedule. You got to finish this job today. Somebody's got to go to crawl down in there and fix that wire. So the idea was that... requiring engineers to perform only in the areas of their competence was going to put the small business engineers out of business.
Has that happened? Or just can small businesses sort of find a way around this campaign?
What happened, I think, in the end was that small business just kept doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
And they, no big cases come up. And the basic attitude that we talked about when I was chair of the committee was that, look, judges and juries are reasonable to some level. At some level, they're going to know that you're not a concrete foreman, but you wanted to pour just enough concrete in here to put an electrical apparatus that your company makes on top of. And nobody came in here on time. You got to do it. So somebody said, well, let's go mix the concrete. I did it for my son's dog house, and you throw it in there. Some jury is going to be sympathetic to that. And just don't let it get out of hand. Don't have a nuclear device in the product you make that goes bad and you try to fix it. Don't go crazy. So I think that what happened with that case was that cooler heads prevailed in there.
Because at first glance, I think we've had a conversation before about, I think it was
Yeah, competency came up in Chernobyl.
And, so yeah, it was an important distinction to make, and it made it clear for me that that's what's unethical. Attempting it, not necessarily that, you know, maybe you're not great at it and you try and you fail. Nothing ethically is wrong. It's just you actually try and attempt to do something you know you're not qualified to do.
Well, that was one of the big issues that I brought to the table as a person who had studied ethics formally. But engineers had very strong sentiments that if you didn't know how to solve a certain kind of problem, you were unethical. And I tried to tell them, no, you got to separate that out. And in the end, cooler heads prevailed on that one too. But there was a basic sentiment among engineers that if there were certain things you didn't know, and you shouldn't be practicing. And it was unethical. And I'll tell you what made their arguments strong, if not entirely compelling. They would make a metaphor with physicians. Okay, so you're sitting up there, your heart is going bad, you're about to die, and a physician comes in and says, well, I never studied the heart, but I will cut your heart out today anyway. I mean, you know, part of it. Now, there's something unethical and competency tied into that. And then they make the metaphor back to engineering, and engineers start thinking, and we have to hold it. Maybe cooler heads will prevail in these situations. Okay, but that was hot. That was a hot issue. And we're not pouring concrete for a column that's going to sustain 30 stories of stuff on top. We just talk about a little thing over here. If it cracks, then we'll pay for it. Yeah. You try to work that, you know, cooler heads prevail in the courtroom sometimes. Take your chances. But I think that underneath the surface, remember I told you there are certain things operating underneath the surface of discussion that nobody would deny, and sometimes some of it has been written. One is that engineers always felt and probably still feel that they are not accepted as professionals like doctors and lawyers are. So, and they're proud of their profession, and mainly because, not because of the good things that are here in this preamble, but because actually what you had said, Ms. Bestia, a couple classes ago, and that was they know what it was like to be in school and take hard courses when everybody else could not pass these courses, and we not only had to pass them but do well in them in order to get a degree. And there's a lot, and there is under the surface in engineering, there is a little bit of bitterness about it. All of that. I know of one case where there was this professor who had something like 200 or 300 publications, was editor of 3 journals. Actually, the guy who told me said it was editor of 4 journals, and was a consultant. you want the answer? It's a term that has 2 words in it. It's called graduate students. He's at the top of his profession. He had this one student that got a master's degree under him, just barely got through. And 5 or 6, 10 years later, that particular former student gave a party at his house. He had gone out and had made gotten a little business and became successful. And when the professor went to the party, the house was 3 times as big as the professor's house. Had a Rolls Royce and you know, one of the 4 parking garages, had 4 full chimneys, you know, the whole bit. And the story goes on about how this man began to drink and wound up in a home.
The professor.
I just tore him up. So you get one story out. There was another story that hit the newspapers. I know about this story personally. because this particular professor taught me a class in graduate school. It turns out that this particular, I won't call a name because in order to call a name, I have to get all my facts right. But the facts are not only on the record in the courts, but they're in the newspapers. This was and in AAUP, all kinds of stuff. But this professor, turns out he was a very good teacher and had published some textbooks. I'm talking about Springer Verlag, top of the line textbooks, required reading at MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, Princeton. But he did not have any research. Okay. None whatsoever. He was just a teacher. Then it came out that he was a full professor with tenure, with a full-time appointment at three different universities simultaneously. And he had his schedule made out so that at one place he had courses only Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the morning. And other places, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the afternoon. And then the one that was out of town in Pennsylvania, he was in Washington, was in Tuesday, Thursday. And they caught him, and they roasted him on a spit. But there was a lot of sympathy for his case. A lot of other factors came in. He had a daughter that was sick, and his wife was dead. You know, all of these things. But there was one other factor that came in there that really worked on the academic profession very hard, and that was, is this what a good teacher has to do in order just to pay bills and stuff? You know, maybe we're doing too much to emphasize the research part of it. And so his case has never been forgotten. So underneath the surface, you have all of these currents. The issue was that it was illegal. That you cannot. The issue was that the president wanted to fire him, and there was a lot of debate on one side or the other as to whether or not a faculty member can have more than one job, and they pointed to this tradition of the one day a week consulting. That there's this understanding that when you take on a faculty position, you've got one day a week to do what you want. And that usually means consulting or doing something that will enhance your abilities to do teaching and research. You're not going to the beach.
Yeah.
But it's up to you to decide. It's just an understanding that has been the case for many, many years. And it has influence in the courts. The courts say they'll get all of these college presidents and people get up and say, yeah, it's just understood. Right? you're supposed to get that one day, but to go and have two other full-time jobs. And not only that, but when you take a job, there's some kind of form you sign. About are you employed someplace else? So they're talking about conflicts of interest now. Right. And for example, here I'm on this sabbatical. I'm asked to join the editorial board of this journal. They say, how should we list you, Howard or MIT? Well, I learned a long time ago that if you are on sabbatical from Howard to another institution, that year, you're at the other institution. When you go back, then you go back on the other one. And the institution where you are on the sabbatical to will have some mean-spirited ideas if you don't give them the recognition and don't give them the prominent recognition. And they don't even like it if they say MIT/Howard. So my dean understand it. I tell you what even set him up one day. I published a paper and put down Duke University. He said, "Wait, are you going to submit that for a raise?" So yeah, he said, well, it's got Duke University on there. I said, yeah, sabbatical from Howard University, and here's my, okay, okay. So in other words, there are some lower level issues that are not contested. They have legal standing. And this particular one with this professor was sort of on the cusp. He found out what they did in the end was they just, all three universities fired him, but one of them gave him his retirement. But it remains, you know the term skeletons in the closet? Where you've got a family and there are little things that everybody knows about but you don't want everybody else to know about? In the academic profession, he's a skeleton in our closet. We really don't want other people to know about his case. The only thing about it that I suffer some bitterness over that. I made one or two phone calls about it because I was a former student. And I was bitter that there just didn't seem to be interest among students. That here's a teacher that, quote unquote, just can't make it in his life. Yeah. So anyway, but a whole lot of other issues got involved and they were nasty. You know, and people just want to sweep it under the table. But I think one thing they've done about that here at MIT is they have a rank called a teaching professor. I know that there's a person in ESD that's called, that has a rank of teaching. Yeah. No, it's called teaching professor. It's Chris McGee. No, he's called professor of the professional practice of engineering.
Yeah.
But there's another one that is, I think in ESD that had, well, you all check that. You all check. But anyway, one way to get around it where at institutions that could afford to do it was to create teaching rank. So you could have a person, distinguished professor for teaching at some place, and all they have to do is teach. They can get their raises without submitting grants. But that's as far as they've gone with that kind of thing. But I'm just trying to say that these things are not secret. You can document all of this, but it still operates below the level of what I call the collective unconscious, the collective consciousness. Nobody really wants to talk about it. And underneath what they say and do will be some of that dust. And you have that here with this code. Okay, let's sweat it out. Let's finish these six and...
Number three is issue public statements only in an objective and truthful manner.
I'll tell you what that was about. All of a sudden, the ordinary engineer became someone that the big news media wanted to interview. that was terrifying. You know, I mean, it's terrifying for a university. All of a sudden, some ordinary professor is on Nightline or is interviewed by the New York Times, you know, stuff like that. And so they really struggled over who could speak for the company when there was a question of nuclear waste or something like that. What can a person say? And the lawyers got involved in that. Free speech. Not that they were defending it, but they were trying to tell the presidents, the CEOs of corporations, that you cannot suppress these employees. Because then the employee will take you to court and win big time. Right? So what can you do? So that was... That issue there was really to cover ordinary people who now become celebrities. And some of them, let's face it, some of them get drunk with being the celebrity. You know what I mean? like, I mean, just think about it. The ordinary things. We've all been through this. I've been through it. You know, when the Challenger went down, Howard University has a TV station. So they had this call-in program. So they asked me to come in and take the calls. And just before the calls come in, I'm sitting down, and they got a makeup artist. So what? You can let that stuff go to your head. You know, it was easy for me. I just did my job and went back to the Library of Congress. But some people, that stuff goes to their heads, and they start making life miserable for a lot of people unnecessarily. So there was a lot of that. Underneath the surface, that came to the surface. Everybody said, well, what they did was, there's a term, I don't know if it's a term of art, but you're going to get it, and it's called wordsmithing. Everybody knew what we had to do. Everybody agreed what we had to do as to what words can we do right down here. And so that particular one was turned out for, I think it's fair to say, for people who are writing codes of ethics, to be a wordsmithing challenge, particularly to get a lawyer in there so that we didn't go over the line. But everybody sort of agreed on the principle.
But it seems like the underlying aim of that principle is to present the company maybe in a more positive manner, so you can't get an employee and get on the news and trash.
Right.
Maybe like underlying, but it seems like that's not necessarily, you could adhere to that and be truthful and maybe say some things that, you know, management might not like, and are being objective and truthful.
Right.
But maybe that is one of the underlying assumptions that management operate on, that you present them in a better light.
Well, definitely that's true. I mean, the way big organizations deal with that is, when they do it, is not to come out and tell everybody that they have to say things that put the company in the best light. What they do is, you're just not going to make it up to management level unless you really feel that way. So it becomes an honest, so if you get a manager up there, the manager is not lying. The manager is the person who was chosen because he or she really feels that way, has that real outlook, everybody believes, and can portray it as something really, something truthful and objective, right? Somebody who feels differently is just not going to make it along those lines, all right? And you hope, when I say you, I mean the CEO hopes that somebody who is not in that line is not being interviewed, and know the newspapers know the structure. They know to get one person to say the party line, they want to get another person to say something else, and they play it against each other, and it's hard to deal with. What happens in the end, I think, is that if you have to do anything like that, and I've learned from experience, is just to say that you are not a spokesman for your corporation. You are an engineer there, and you're speaking from the perspective of an engineer there, and this is my perspective and my outlook and my experience. But you don't drag... You don't take credit for saying, well, at my company, we, you don't make statements like that. Somebody else can do it, but you can't do it. Okay, how many more we got?
Three?
Let's knock them out.
Number four. Act for each employer or client as faithful agents or trustees.
Yes. What is a faithful agent? We got that from lawyers. Right.
Not accepting compensation from more than one party for services on something. Not soliciting or accepting financial consideration from outside agents.
Right. So those are the particulars on this issue of faithful agency. Right. So when you you might go to a contractor and say, I need another wing put on my house. You want to believe that the contractor has your interest in paramount, okay, first, and that the person is not saying, well, you know, the real estate agency thinks that the market in this neighborhood will be higher if we don't have a whole lot of extensions put on these homes. I don't know why they would say that, but I'm making up a case. And so they go to this meeting with the contractors and say, well, look, it's not in our interest for having all of these things. So what the contractor does is come back, let's say, and says, well, you know, quote you the highest prices on everything, try to discourage you from doing it. We don't want that. Okay, the contractor is supposed to say, no matter what the other interests are, I am your agent, and you, if you want this house thing put on, here are the prices. These are the best prices. Okay. And you don't need to have steel put in as a column for a one-story extension of your kitchen. We can do that with a 4x4 piece of wood. But you got to get a good piece of wood now, hardwood. So this is the kind you get, save yourself $2,000 or $3,000. Okay, so they don't want you playing that, those kinds of games. They want the client or whoever you're working for. It's like, the good example is with the legal profession. A lot of them believe that their client, you know, they're going to be agents for their client. So, I mean, you could be a notorious killer. If you're supposed to defend that client, guess what you're supposed to do? Do your best to defend that client. What's next?
Avoid deceptive acts, which I think ties
into. Yeah. That one, is that what we would call an easy one? Give us some specifics. What are the specifics? One or two specifics.
Engineers should not falsify their qualifications.
Oh.
Or permit misrepresentation of their associates.
We had a case at Howard where a faculty member in engineering, oh, this was a terrible case for other reasons, if you want to know them out, we got time to go in. But what he did was he submitted credentials of 200 publications. Had them nicely sit down. And he came in from another university, and the department gave him full professor tenure.
Based on his presentation of those 200.
Yeah. Mainly. 99%. Okay. There was some question as to why he never made full at any of his previous places, but that is usually answered by the real problem, of the real case that maybe it just didn't fit in. Okay. So I can think of some very talented professors that will not fit in at Howard. Okay. So we brought the professor down. Well, he did something else that was totally irrelevant to that, that everybody wanted to fire him for. So the department is building up a case against him. So they go back through his resume. What they found out was that almost all of his publications were what you call commentaries. So you publish an article. It comes out, and in many journals will allow a certain period of time, like a year, calendar year, for the rest of us to say, well, you know, I think that the equation 3.2 in her report was incorrect. It left out the square term. You put in the square term and send it back, and they publish it right along. He had 200 commentary papers. Now, we felt deceived. We had made a contract with Mephistopheles and stuff. We thought that he should have put in. Now, I make do commentary papers.
Yeah.
But when I put all of the credentials down in for the commentary, I have a square bracket at the end that says commentary table. Or actually, what I do in my resume, I think you should look at my resume. I got commentary paper, I think, right up after the title. But I make sure that it's commentary paper. Now, what I do to give a little bit of credit for myself is that the commentary papers I've written were what they call invited commentaries. The editor will send me a copy of the paper and say, look, we need a commentary on it. I'm not sitting there saying, oh, I think this equation 3.2 is wrong. Not that I wouldn't. It just has not happened for me in my career to do that. So I will put invited commentary down there to give it a little more status. Nothing wrong. But so that's a deception that, and this was an engineer, so I'm looking at it as not just academic profession, but as engineering. This guy deceived us as we were engineering colleagues. Yeah. It's also a scary situation to be in, isn't it? So read it, please.
Well, okay, so the six can't, well.
Chris, that could be really odd.
No, that's you're not. So we just did the fifth canon, which is avoid deceptive acts. And then the sixth canon is conduct themselves honorably, responsibly, ethically, and lawfully so as to enhance the honor, reputation, and usefulness of the profession.
Yeah, I always had an objection to that.
Yeah.
I don't have any obligation to enhance the profession. No.
You don't have any obligation.
I don't think
so.
Certainly no moral obligation.
It seems like the whole section professional obligations pertains to that canon. And what you just brought up is under professional obligations. So it says, engineers shall advise their clients or employers when they believe a project will not be successful.
Okay. Well, and so far as, let me mention this, that I stand almost alone in this when it comes to enhancing the profession. I don't believe that I have any obligation, but I have been overruled.
What's the argument then?
Okay. I was thinking of a metaphor. Let me just put the argument down. If a profession is going to be honorable, it has to be honorable without our making it honorable. No, but I shouldn't have to do anything other than the minimum to make it honorable. I don't going beyond and saying I have some respect for the honor of the profession. Well, that's sort of circular. If the profession is honorable, it's got to earn it. I shouldn't have to go around and do something extra to make it honorable. Okay. It should be honorable because of what it is.
All the things that came before, following all of those things,
yeah,
should maintain.
Make it honorable. Right. I shouldn't have to go outside of that to enhance the honor. Right. Because if you say that engineering is honorable, then I should only have to do engineering and it will be honorable. Then you have deceived me if I have to do more than that to make it honorable. So I stand firm on my position, but I'm the only one out there saying this.
Yeah, I guess I think maybe that enhancing the honor, enhancing the public reputation of engineering, like enhancing it, not just maintaining it, is more something is yeah. The code of ethics that you sign?
The code of ethics should be the minimum.
Yeah.
And the minimum should be good enough. And anything that I do above the minimum is my business, but not an obligation. All of these words in ethics, duty, obligation, they're talking about minimums. If you go beyond that, that's good, but I don't have to go beyond it.
But a lot of people feel like it belongs in the fundamental canons.
Yes, and I was overruled everywhere. Okay, we've got two more minutes. I think that you've already picked up that the other codes of ethics do not differ substantially, or if they do, it's mainly by abbreviation of this code. The AAES code is unique in as much as it stands. It offers it's called model guide or code, and it tries to get some kind of coherence among all of the professional societies that belong to the AAES. Individuals don't belong. Okay.
So who has, so does that mean that the AAES code does not obligate anyone? Like it's just a model?
It's just a model. But the reason for it is that engineers were advised by high-level people in Congress that engineering does not have force among in Congress like the AMA has, because the AMA can speak for the whole profession, and engineering, you got 10, 12 different organizations saying different things. So if you believe that engineering should have some force among congressional people, should have a lobbying dimension, then try to make your code as consistent with the AAES model code as you can, and that gets us closer to that. Other than that, you're free to do whatever you want. Okay, so we're going to have a special event coming up Friday for those of us who want to go. I want to go. I'll be there. And give us a little 5 minutes on Tuesday. I hadn't thought about it.
Will you email us?
If I think of something on Sunday night, I won't. That'll be too late.
Okay.
But
if there's anything you want us to read.
Unless I get a brilliant idea, and I think my brain is not ready for any brilliant ideas right now. Unless I get a brilliant idea, I'll just close out the discussion with codes of ethics. And professionalism.
Can we talk about just in general the basic codes of ethics? Because
yeah,
I mean, it's nice to just take the principal approach and say this is. But I think there are probably some arguments that can be made. I mean, use the example of a professor who again violated various aspects of a certain code.
Right.
But did he really do anything so horrible and so wrong?
Right.
So can maybe talk about that?
By all means, bring it up. Oh, I've got some stuff to say on that. You know me by now. I got something to say. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.